Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. It's the height of summer, but not too soon for parents and teachers to be thinking about the coming school year. We'll hear a report from correspondent Rob Manning about trends in Oregon showing that by 2027, the majority of Oregon grade school students will be non-white. At the same time, Jacob Lewin tells us that despite studies showing benefits to all students in maintaining summer education, the support for summer school for migrant children is shrinking. This is The Bridge for the week of July 21st. Edward Stratton from the Daily Historian has our top story in this edition. Residents are emptying out of the Pier 38 RV park after the owners moved to close the park by September. Several residents have sought legal representation, claiming they're being illegally forced out.
The RV park and adjacent Hampton Inn and Suites are both owned by Pier 38 Marina and RV Park, whose registered agent is Karshan Patel. The company issued a press release Tuesday saying it would shut down the park, although current and previous residents say the rousting started in June. Pier 38 issued a press release Tuesday saying managing the transient guests was becoming a challenge. The owner said there are no plans to currently develop the land. Blair Henningsgaard, an attorney for Pier 38, said he has been asked by the owners to draft eviction notices for several remaining tenants. Floyd Holcomb, a former owner of the RV park and owner of lots over the Columbia River in front of Pier 38 and around his Pier 39 commercial waterfront building, said he was asked by management to help deal with drug issues and residents he said have not been following the rules or keeping their vehicle registration or insurance up to date. Holcomb said the park was never meant for long-term residents and that the tenants were exposing the park to liability concerns. Multiple residents, though, say they have lived there for several months to more than 2 years. Portland attorney Scott Staub is representing Pier 38 tenant Josh Redburn and Michelle Charlton, who said she paid her rent in advance but was not allowed to park her trailer that she had towed from Portland. Charlton and Redburn both called the police on Pier 38 July 5th, claiming they had been confronted by management and verbally harassed by Holcomb. Redburn said management has subsequently tried to kick him out, but that he refuses to leave without a written 30-day eviction notice as required by law. Staub said he delivered a cease and desist letter recently ordering the company to follow landlord-tenant laws in its evictions of residents. He claimed the landlords have also been intermittently shutting off water and power, threatening to tow away trailers, and using police contact as a way to evict tenants. Staub said he is seeking compensation for his clients and will file a lawsuit if necessary. Jeremy Fisher, a former resident of the park for more than 2 years, said he recently left his trailer and moved in with friends after management would not allow him to pay rent and shut off his utilities. Former Pier 38 resident Frank Riley was accused of park management of having a methamphetamine lab in his trailer, although he was later cleared by police. Riley has moved across town and said he has contemplated contacting an attorney. The park switched managers from Chad Copeland to Michael Earps last month. According to Astoria Police Department, there have been 12 complaints against Earps since June 17th. Multiple log entries show Earps attempting to make residents leave and being told by officers he needs to follow the proper eviction process. This is Edward Stratton of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
One dirty truth, literally, about child rearing is the high cost of diapers. They cost families from $70 to $80 a month per child. Congress is considering legislation that would fund pilot programs in states such as Oregon to help low-income families afford the necessity. Currently, no federal program meets that need, according to Allison Weir with the National Diaper Bank Network.
You tell people that you can't buy diapers with food stamps or WIC, and the first response is, what? Neither program is meant for that, but the programs that were meant to provide for the basic needs have all shrunk to the point where there's a big hole in the safety net.
TAMF, or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is the only program that provides money that could be used for diapers. In a single-parent home with two children in Oregon, diapers account for 16% of total TAMF benefits. Weir says the pressure to provide diapers for their children often forces parents to make tough choices. It's a fact illustrated by a survey from Feeding America, in which parents shared some surprising confessions.
A large number of folks admitted delaying changing a diaper or, in some cases, shaking a diaper out and trying to reuse it. And if you don't have diapers, in most cases you can't leave your child at daycare because most daycares require parents to provide the diapers your child will use.
There is currently one diaper bank in Oregon, located in Portland. Of the 136,000 children in the state under age 3, more than one quarter live in households earning less than the federal poverty line. When the doors closed for school last month, many Oregon teachers and students hit the road for vacations or to visit family. But not everyone does. Some teachers stick around to run programs for students who tend to move during the school year. Rob Manning reports on why summer school for migrant kids is shrinking.
Gustavo Molina has 29 students in a blended class of second and third graders. He says over the summers, he's seen budgets get tighter.
That's the reason why in this program we have two grades and one with more than 20 students, when a lot of these children will benefit more of having a smaller class and being in a single grade and with more resources.
It's a simple math problem that Oregon school administrators know all too well. When funding follows students, money will get scarce if student numbers drop. Portland Public Schools' total population has gone up recently, but the migrant population has not.
We had last year almost 400 students. Right now we are at 300.
Teresa Rule has helped run the migrant student programs, including the summer school, for 17 years. She says the migrant population started changing a decade ago.
At the beginning, we were have migrants who were also not just Hispanic. We had Vietnamese and other Asian cultures. Around 2005, it started changing, and it became mostly Hispanic, and now is 100% Hispanic.
And recently, Rule says rising housing costs have forced out many of Portland's Hispanic migrants.
They went to Vancouver. Some and other families have gone to Gresham and other areas because the housing problems that we have right now, because it's so expensive to live in Portland, and most of our families have left.
That makes the summer programs for migrants smaller and more difficult to run, says Portland Public Administrator Kathy Guyten.
That becomes an issue. It's what makes a viable program. In Oregon City, for example, they don't have sufficient numbers of students, from what I understand, so they contract with Canby, which has a very large migrant population and a large summer school program.
The summer program runs only two school buses to pick up students. It means not serving whole Portland neighborhoods. The program leans on volunteers, particularly parents, Guyten points out.
Yeah. These two are moms who are volunteering, also helping the kids. They're doing pre-assessment.
The program also offers classes to parents and even sometimes connects them with higher education. If the program is successful, it means adults may find jobs that keep them from migrating, which in turn could cause the program to shrink. That's kind of the story with Sylvia Moreno Aguilar and her daughter, Princesa. They're both at the summer program every day, but when it's over, they plan to head to the farms in Idaho. Princesa is looking forward to it.
For me, it's fun because, like, we get to plant things, we get to work as a team, and I learn more things about my parents than just staying in the city.
Her mom recently finished a 2-year degree in medical assisting. She says going to Idaho takes on different significance.
Now we are not in a big need to go outside on the fields, but we are trying to show, you know, my kids that if they don't have a good education, they're gonna, you know, stay on the fields and work as hard, you know, like we were working before.
Aguilar and her daughter, Princesa, have big plans for the future. The fifth grader explains.
I want to be a doctor, and my mom, she already graduated from medical assistant. I'm proud of that because me and my mom have a dream of working together. She did her part, now I have to study, and I'm trying so hard to study because it's one of my dreams.
Portland Public Schools has adjusted recently by opening the program to students who are low income but not migrant. That opens up other limited federal funds. The Migrant Summer School wraps up this week.
I'm Rob Manning reporting.
20 years from now, based on existing trends, Oregon public schools will be majority-minority. Oregon still has a 10-point achievement gap between minorities and whites, and students of colors become a larger part of the school population. Closing that gap becomes more important. Jacob Lewin reports on one Oregon high school and Western Oregon State University, where the issue is being successfully addressed.
The graduation rate at Newport High School is 84% for Latinos and 76% for whites. But Principal John Zagel cares less about standing the achievement gap on its head than about the growing percentage of Latinos who are graduating.
We're really proud about the achievement gap closing, but we didn't concentrate on a certain subgroup. Every kid that walks through our door gets our 100% concern, and we help them as much as we can. Our Spanish-speaking students, they are just part of us. I don't even consider them a subgroup.
Parent Ana Laura Hernandez says getting clear progress reports on her kids empowers her.
They open the doors to the parents.
Administrators make it a point to literally get Latino parents into school for events, including theater, sports, and school band concerts.
Ready? One, two.
Principal Zagel says counselors help kids with social problems, big and small.
Some of our Spanish-speaking students struggle with how to do things in our world, from I need a prom dress to I need a little bit extra help studying for the SAT. And we have amazing staff members that help them with non-school stuff so they can be successful at school.
Latino students in Newport say it's all about the support.
My name's Chelsea Alatriste. I am 16. I am an IB diploma candidate. I want to pursue a career either as a criminal defense lawyer or as an immigration lawyer. I think that the biggest part is the sense of community that our school has.
My name is Galilea Maldonado. I'm 17. I'm also an IB diploma candidate, and I aspire to be a nurse practitioner. Newport is a small town, and that allows us to get to know each other a lot more. There's more attention towards the students since the classes are relatively small.
There is one other essential piece to this puzzle. When Latinos came to Newport for jobs in the hospitality and fish processing industries, they didn't expect that they or their children would stay. Now they do, and that's changed their attitudes. Alejandra Ponciano is a Newport High parent.
I got here in 1993, and since then, our community is growing and growing, and many parents just came here to work and put those kids to work. Now, parents are involved with the dreams or what their kids want to be.
Here on the leafy campus of Western Oregon University, you'll see a lot of diversity. Unlike Newport High, Associate Provost Dave McDonald says his school has intentionally set out to close the achievement gap.
The population that was at greatest risk of being left behind was, in fact, the Latino population. It was fastest growing, already had a sizable number of Latinos in Oregon, and had among the lowest achievement rates in terms of high school completion, college entry, college completion.
Like Newport High, Western tries to address the whole student.
Our programs provide wraparound services that start with the academics, but address the other issues too, the social issues, the adjustment issues, the value and benefit of having an engaged family. Often though, the family is threatened by the separation that occurs when the student goes off to college.
Much of the staff is bilingual, not so much for the benefit of the students, but for the parents. There's much more student involvement with advisors. In fact, it's required. Half the students, like Vanessa Sandoval, are the first in their family to go to college.
It's giving you advice that you wouldn't find anywhere else, and that is a huge piece, especially if no one you knew went to college. And so you're doing this by yourself, and you're trying to learn things that it feels like everyone else already knows.
And student Javier Garcia.
Western was the only school that actually believed in me. I didn't even believe myself, even the first year being here. I was telling my advisor I'll be here for a couple months, probably drop out, and I'm still here, which is really nice.
While courting Latinos has helped WOU stabilize enrollment, the school still has its work cut out. While the Latino graduation rate is 10 points higher than the white rate, only about 55% do graduate. In Monmouth, I'm Jacob Lewin, KLCC News.
There was very exciting news in education last week. The Earth Science Department at Oregon State University received a $10 million gift to study volcanoes.
The donation will allow the department to focus on studying active volcanoes and the hazards they present. This money comes from Oregon's Board of Trustees Chair Chuck Lillis and his wife Gwen. The Lillises are longtime donors of the U of O, having donated $12 million to help fund the Lillis Business Complex in 1999. Paul Wallace, the chairman of the Earth Sciences Department, says the money will help provide more classes, training, and opportunities to participate in research programs.
We have major research programs in volcanology where we can train students to go on and work with the U.S. Geological Survey or with other government agencies and so forth.
Wallace adds the money will allow them to hire two new faculty. The goal is to diversify the program and design multidisciplinary volcanic studies.
That it will really give us a critical mass of people in doing different types of volcanology that will help us to compete better for large research grants from the National Science Foundation, from NASA, and from other federal agencies.
This donation from the Lillis family comes less than 2 weeks after Wallace's first day on the job.
You can't have a better first day on the job as the new department head.
This is Kira Hoffelmeyer reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. If you're a farmer or a part-time gardener, you know how destructive birds can be to a crop. Next, we'll hear about an innovative engineering feat that was supposed to solve water temperature problems below the Round Butte Dam on the Lower Deschutes River. Portland General Electric installed a giant tower to blend warm reservoir water with cold. Instead, conservationists complain that this tinkering with Mother Nature has created more environmental problems than it's solved. Amanda Preacher reports.
Greg McMillan peers into the Metolius River on a chilly May morning. He drops a plastic water collection device off the side of his powerboat.
This water is about as clear as you can get.
McMillan is president of the conservation group the Deschutes River Alliance. He's doing the kind of water quality testing that he thinks Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality should be doing.
Yeah, it looks like our pH is coming in right at about 7.21, 7.22. This is very clean water, clear and cold.
But the two other tributaries of the Lower Deschutes don't tend to be so clear and cold. Downstream of McMillan's boat, the Metolius meets the Middle Deschutes and Crooked Rivers in Lake Billy Chinook. That's the Jefferson County Reservoir created by PGE's Round Butte Dam. For years, the water that came out of the bottom of the Round Butte Dam was from the Metolius River, clear and cold. Too cold for fish, according to Oregon's Department of Fish and Wildlife. So 7 years ago, PGE and the Warm Springs Tribe spent $110 million to install a giant underwater mixing device. PGE's Megan Hill explains how it works.
So to remove the influence the dam has on temperature, we're able to blend top water, which tends to be warmer, with the cooler bottom water.
Rod French is a fisheries biologist with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says the adjusted temperatures are better for fish.
We feel that that's the natural regime that these fish evolved with over time and probably the healthiest for the populations as a whole.
But for other water quality measures like dissolved oxygen and pH, the mixing tower may have created more problems than solutions. The Deschutes River Alliance says PGE's own water quality reports show it's violated water quality standards more than 1,200 times without facing consequences.
Well, it just looks like the DEQ was trying to be very accommodating to what PGE was asking for.
Rick Hafley is a retired DEQ water quality manager who now serves on the conservation group's board. He says state regulators, his former colleagues, have lowered water quality standards.
Rather than looking at what's best for the stream, they were kind of like, well, what's best for this project that PGE's been spending a lot of money on?
But Eric Nigg with DEQ says the conservation group exaggerates PGE's water quality transgressions.
It isn't necessarily considered a violation on, for instance, every day when they don't meet a standard.
Nick says regulators give PGE flexibility because they're working to meet the standards. He points out that the mixing device is relatively new.
At this point, the important part is that they're continuing to try and understand the system.
On top of the challenges with pH and dissolved oxygen, there are other changes in the Lower Deschutes. Lee Ann Ross is president of the Central Oregon Fly Fishers.
Clearly, as fishermen, we see a difference. There's some algae in the river that didn't used to be there. That algae can suffocate the bugs.
DEQ says the algae increase was unexpected and that the new downstream mix, which was of course an intended consequence of the mixing tower, might be why slime blooms are on the rise. Steve Corson from PGE says his company is doing everything state regulators ask. On top of that, he says the utility is constantly looking at ways to improve river health.
And it's a long-term commitment. It's not something that we expected to be able to, you know, put a gold star on after 6 years and declare that we're done. It's something that's going to take some time and a lot of collaborative effort within the basin.
Conservationists believe PGE and DEQ have had enough time. Last month, the Deschutes River Alliance announced its intent to sue. They want PGE to meet all water quality standards all the time. And in the long term, they want the utility to go back to releasing water from the bottom of the reservoir. PGE spokesman Steve Corson says his company will challenge the lawsuit. For OPB, I'm Amanda Peacher on the Lower Deschutes River.
Correspondent Emily Schwing has our next story, and perhaps a solution to those pesky birds. We'll meet a modern-day falconer and a peregrine falcon named Shaman. Over orchards and vineyards across the Northwest, European starlings are eating fruit. Well, this man has raptors for hire to scare them off.
It's barely 6 a.m., but Vahe Alaverdian has been out in a field of cherry trees since dawn.
Like this, vertical. Hop, hop, hop. There you go.
He's working with a fierce peregrine falcon called Shaman.
Hop.
Eventually, Alaverdian makes a special call.
Hop. Hey!
And Shaman lands to claim a prize.
Good boy. He gets quail.
The bluish-gray-winged bird chows down on a chunk of raw meat, and then we climb into a pickup truck to patrol another field down the road. Birds like starlings and finches, the species that love to eat ripening fruit, are prey for peregrine falcons like Shaman. So as long as he flies here, other birds won't, and that makes Mark Roy happy. He's a fourth-generation fruit grower and a member of the Washington State Fruit Commission.
I would think that we're saving up to $1,000 a day in fruit that's not damaged.
On this day, pickers also rose early to pull handfuls of ripe cherries from Roy's trees, just outside Moxie, a small town in Washington's Yakima Valley. Roy also grows apples. He says an analysis by the U.S. Department of Agriculture showed that he was losing up to 8% of his apples to hungry birds.
So, I mean, it pays to come and to scare the birds away.
Traditional methods like scarecrows, pyrotechnics, and netting weren't working. So Roy called Alaverdian.
Well, bird abatement's fairly new, meaning like the last two decades it has really picked up. Ecologically and sustainability speaking, it's becoming more and more popular because of, you know, how green it is and how clean it is and so on.
But Falcon Force, as this business is known, isn't cheap. Shaman and the other raptors Alaverdian works with bring in up to $75 an hour. During the height of the growing season, they'll work fields for 12 to 14 hours, so a single contract could bring in $70,000.
And we'll just go to the far end here and see.
As he drives around the orchard scouting for starlings, Alaverdian says his birds likely save growers even more than what Mark Roy estimates.
Let's say we're doing wine grapes, right? So it takes $400 per acre to buy the netting. Traditionally, they net the wine grapes, right? Pay for the labor to put it on and peel it off before harvest, right?
Many wineries exceed 1,000 acres, so netting can cost up to $400,000 a year, and it's still not starling-proof.
Your netting is stretched over the fruit, so it gives the starling something to bind into, hold on to, while they eat the fruit right through the netting. So they still take as much as 30% damage. Whereas with us, we can bring that down to 5 to 7% damage.
Alaverdian has been a lifelong falconer. He started doing abatement work professionally in 2009. Then, just a few years ago, people thought they had a new, modern answer to the starling problem, drones.
People said, oh, we're going to put you out of business. We've got drones. We're going to program these drones and fly more blueberries. And then what, you know?
Like scarecrows and shotguns, they didn't seem to actually scare birds away.
It's just not something that they are genetically programmed to want to avoid. It's good for 48 hours, and then you need another tool. Yeah, boy.
For Alaverdian, his tool is the kind with talons.
Hup.
In Moxie, I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
I wonder how Shaman would do against the sea lions on Pier 39. That's the sound of a horned lark. Horned larks are small birds that live in large empty fields, and they're roughly the same color and size of a dirt clod. A canola farmer in Adams County, Washington, has been left without his entire crop thanks to hundreds of horned larks who've decided to use his field for a buffet. J.R. Swinger says at first he thought the birds were eating the seeds, but on second inspection they were snapping up the very tip of the sprout, without which his canola plants can't grow. Swinger says the sprout, called a cotyledon, only exists for a few days, and once it grew slightly, the birds didn't want to eat it anymore. Washington State University professor Bill Schillinger says he too faced the lark issue and can't find a solution. He says he's called canola farmers in other parts of the country, and they don't see the birds. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.